This is A Lost Plot, the podcast where we explore meaning in movies together.
This is the second part to a two-part series. If you have not listened to the first part yet, we encourage you to go back and listen to the first part, where we provide more context, the background for everything that's going on here. Otherwise, thank you for joining us, and onward. So, going back into this discussion of The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, there is a lot of great characters that we've seen developed. There's some discussion on whether or not those were better in the books or the movies, but they have a lot, I think, going for them in regards to we know each of these individual characters, who they are, and what they're fighting for. So is there a lot at stake for these characters, especially is there something that they're willing, that they're potentially going to sacrifice in this movie?
Yeah, I mean, you've got what more could there be at stake? You know, it's an epic battle of good versus evil. You've got Sauron, who will throw the world into darkness and enslave all of you. They have everything to lose, especially the main characters. You've got Frodo, who's giving up literally everything. He gives up, you know, from the start of the series. I know it's outside the scope of this movie, but he gives up his home in the Shire. Right. He moves out to Mickle Delving. And then he gives up all comforts and moves on, and he's walking some ludicrous number of miles to get to a place that nobody wants to go, and Sam goes with him. And that, I don't know how you can give up much more than that. Mm-hmm. So super compelling. There's every reason for everybody in this movie to fight and to fight hard. And I mean, like, that's, you know, the books provide like a great, great basis for any reason why anybody would want to be involved. It's everything's up in the air for all of these people.
No, I definitely agree. I think that it's pretty clearly spelled out. This is one time where it's spelled out more clearly in The Fellowship of the Ring, where you have Frodo gaze into the Pool of Galadriel and he sees what the future holds potentially for his people. But it's still pretty well established in this movie, where they are constantly going back to everyone's going to die. No one's going to live through this, and that's definitely going to be the case. What about the villain? Sauron, as a character, do you think he's a compelling villain? What did you think?
Yeah, I thought in the movie, you've got the Witch King. And I think that really, in both the book and the movie, you kind of have to treat it as like, Sauron is the overarching villain of the entire series. He's the he's the end villain. But for the best, for the biggest chunk of the Return of the King, it's really the Witch King who's driving the army ahead of him and who you're going to have to fight. So you get that. He is a very compelling character, especially in the books, where you get some of his background. You get this, like, he's been an enemy of Gondor for age immemorial. I think Gandalf does, in the movie, there is an aside where he talks, I think maybe to Pippin, about who the Witch King is. And that this is the Witch King of Angmar, who we know is the head of the Nazgul. And that's so he's a compelling villain in both the book and the movie, I think. Right. And you get these scenes where the Nazgul and the Witch King are riding their giant, terrifying beasts over the walls of Gondor, just picking people up and throwing them on the ground. And it's very cool shots. This is one of those things where it's like, you can be a little nitpicky here and say, okay, well, in the books, you know, strategically, the Witch King would have been at the back, driving people in front of him with his fear and the darkness, and you wouldn't necessarily have had all of the Nazgul out there riding. I don't think that's not a hill I'm going to die on.
Right.
You get some really cool shots because of this, and you get, I think he remains a compelling character, and you get to see him. Whoever, I don't know who voiced the Witch King, great job.
Yeah.
Really scary. So, I think he's a great villain. Sauron, that's kind of where the movies get me a little bit, because he's the overarching villain.
Right.
I think less is more with Sauron. And in the books, it's like Alien in my mind. One of the best movie villains ever. And I mean, like, villain is kind of hard to say because it's alien. It's hard to say whether or not it's mindless or an animal, but terrifying nonetheless. Mm-hmm. And mostly terrifying because it's not seen, it's only felt. Mm-hmm. It's felt in tension between the characters, and it's like you see these beeping dots on the screen. And wrong movie, but great villain. And I think that, you know, you can take that lesson, you can impose it onto almost anything, because Sauron is, in the books, he is this formless thing that lives in this void, that is just this malice that is influencing everything. So he lost his body in the fall of Numenor, mm-hmm. and his spirit is alive and directing things from Barad-dûr. There is no eye. And I think most people know that. There is no actual flaming eye. That's metaphorical in the books. The idea is that it's Sauron's big brother. He's got his eye on you. He can see everything because he's a spirit. He's not contained by this world.
Okay. That's so funny.
So having the eye, the literal eye on the tower, is just like, oh my gosh, what are you doing? And it's if it were just that, I would have been like, okay.
Oh my gosh.
That's kind of silly, but whatever. You gotta show us something. But then to have the eye like spotlight
the lighthouse look over
Gorgoroth is just, I was laughing. I was like, this takes me completely out of it. It's silly. So,
that's so funny. You know,
50-50, really, really good villain in the first half with the Witch King. Excellently done. I think they did a good job with that. And then Sauron is just kind of like, less is more, guys. You could do a bit more if you did a bit less, honestly.
I do. So that's very interesting with the eye. I do think that it's been so long. In some ways, I think at this point, the Eye of Sauron is iconic in some ways as a type of entity that exists that doesn't actually have a body, right? And so, I mean, there's a part of me that internally is like, oh, I don't believe you. It's not in the books. There's no way. But, there's a part of me that's like, oh, man, that's crazy. I personally like the representation of the eye. I do think that it's interesting to think about, okay, like, is it a good representation? Is it not? I think they do some creative things with it. And at the very least, from a visual perspective, gives you a representation of this evil that you wouldn't get if you didn't actually have some sort of physical form for it, right? I don't know, especially because, and we've had a discussion on the podcast before on villains, right? And what makes a good villain. The villain of Sauron being, and there's generally two routes you go with villains, right? You either have a villain that in some ways is revealed and manifested very clearly as someone that you understand and can relate to where they're coming from, but don't agree with their methods and an avenue of taking that route, right? Where it's like, okay, you could in some ways say Sméagol, right? Someone who you see where they're coming from, how they came to who they are, but don't think they're a good person, don't agree with how they're going about doing things, all of that type of stuff, right? And so you have the more relatable villain who is a terrible person but has some motive, and then you have the other avenue, which is completely mysterious, right? They are a dark force. You don't know where they're coming from. You might know why or why not they're doing something, but generally they're shrouded in a mystery and darkness. And sometimes, like you said, with Alien, you don't see them, or Signs, you don't see them till the end, which actually kind of ruins the movie for me. But, you know, there's other scenes where you have a foreboding evil, and because you don't see it, you don't know what to think. And your mind in some ways fills it in and goes, it's so much worse than I imagined, right? And I mean, honestly, that is one thing I do recall from reading the books for the first time was, as bad as Shelob is as a spider in the movies, it was worse in my mind because of how they paint it in the books. And so there is a sense in which like the unknown terror of something is part of the terror of it. So I don't think the eye dissolves the mystery from him as a character. I do think I agree that the lighthouse spotlight type thing is not ideal. I don't think it kills it for me, but I think it is a little bit of something to be said for that.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think I see where you're coming from in terms of like cinematically, how do you do, and this is similar with like when we get to the conversation about Aragorn and the paths of the dead and the ghosts.
Right.
How do you do that? Like, how do you do that in a compelling way that's the audience is going to understand and is going to show well on a screen? Right. So I can understand where you're coming from with the eye.
Nice. Cool. Well, let's not get too bogged down, but I do think that that's good. Do you think there's an ideal that the main characters stand for and is the goal that they're fighting for important for their lives?
Yeah, I mean, undoubtedly. I'm sure that in other movies that might be a little less clear, but like, it's the ideal. It's essentially, I mean, you've got individual goals, of course. Frodo wants to destroy the ring to protect and save the world. Aragorn wants to destroy Sauron and take his rightful place as King of Gondor and also marry Arwen. Because that's the dealio that Elrond gave him. Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any confusion about why they're there, whether or not what they're doing is worth doing. It's pretty well laid out.
No, I'd agree. And I think that there are some real good ideals that you can see in this movie, things that these characters stand for that transcends the movies in some ways and makes them characters that we can relate to on a more individual level. And this maybe goes back to like what you were saying earlier, where they in some ways maybe try to make these characters too human or too relatable. And you can still have a character who is far different from us, let's just say a hobbit, and they still stand for something that at the end of the day we can cling to and understand as a very good thing and something to strive for. So in my mind, Frodo stands for this ideal of perseverance in the midst of darkness, right? And I think Aragorn in some ways stands for the courage that we see in the world and to really fight for your calling, especially in the movies. I think in the books, based on what you've said, it might be different. But I do think that those things are things that we can relate to as individuals and say, yes, persevering in the midst of evil is worth doing, right? Even if we don't know that we will survive or win, you know, if you're, you know, a drug addict stuck in the midst of your addiction and you say, well, I don't know that I will survive this drug addiction, but I can persevere through today. That is an ideal to stand for. And so there is a sense in which these ideals can transcend the movie and speak into our lives in a very real way.
Yeah. I think the gripe that I would have with the movies is that honestly, the scope is a little too small in terms of their goal. Well, specifically for Gandalf, I wouldn't say necessarily so for not even Aragorn, or Denethor certainly, but their goal is protection of Gondor. And humanity is the savior of all these things. And there is this moment in the books, which is so telling of who Gandalf is as a person, is Denethor is saying, if Gondor falls, everything's lost. So who cares? And he says, Gondor is going to fall, so who cares? And that's his logic.
Right.
And Gandalf says, I'm the steward of more than just Gondor. And you have these moments throughout these books where you see that Gandalf and other characters are looking at something far larger and far greater good. And it's far larger, extends to not just the men of Gondor, extends to the hobbits, and not just the hobbits, but to all of nature, not just to all of nature, but to the cosmos. And you see this, I'm happy the movie kept this line in, and maybe it's just in the extended edition, but Sam has a moment where he's talking to Frodo and he sees the stars peeping out. Over the fields of Gorgoroth. And it's this really beautiful line. And the movie kind of is like, it included it, but it feels a little truncated and it's like, it's a little lost in everything else that's going on. And I think that's because, you know, you don't get this you, and it's, I don't even know how you would do this in a movie. So I'd like, don't ask me, but sure. Trying to convey this feeling of like, we're fighting for more than just Gondor. This is more than just a local thing. This is, we're fighting for all good.
Mm-hmm.
And I went and I found this passage in the book because I thought it was so good and it's so well written and I just want to read it. And it's far above the Ethelduath in the west, the night sky was still dim and pale. There, peeping among the cloud rack above a dark tor high up in the mountains, Sam saw a white star twinkle for a while. The beauty of it smote his heart as he looked up out of the forsaken land and hope returned to him. For like a shaft, clear and cold, the thought pierced him that in the end, the shadow was only a small and passing thing. There was light and high beauty forever beyond its reach.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, that is just Tolkien.
Yeah.
That is these books at their core. And I think mm-hmm. that's the thing that like, really, when I watch the movies, that's the thing I don't get when I watch mm-hmm. them. And so that's my nitpick for that specific section. I think that narratively their goals make sense. There's a lot to lose. There's a lot to gain.
Yeah.
But you lose that. And that's sad.
You mean just like the small bits of hope maybe in the middle of the story or what are you specifically concerned about there? I do like that passage, by the way. That's an excellent one.
it's not there's subtleties in Tolkien's writing. And it's something you get when you read the whole story and this overarching theme that mm-hmm. it's these small moments that actually make up the feeling of the entire story and make up the entire point. Because what mm-hmm. are they really fighting for?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you get this kind of epicness to it, where it's like there is this in this small moment in this world, and this epic covers this. But there's so much more out there. And there's so much good to be fighting for, so much good to continue in on. And you just don't really get that in the movies, which is sad.
Yeah.
So it's ironic because it is small moments like that that make that up. But it's ultimately, I think, one of the biggest themes in the books.
Hmm. Yeah, that hope that they get. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's well, it's interesting because well, a little side bit about myself is that part of the reason for me starting this podcast is that it's supposed to inspire me to write more. I do enjoy writing creatively on my own. And so I was working on a short story over the past month and it's interesting to think about how the writing of these stories is oftentimes made up of these small bits because those are what build into the bigger moments. And especially when it comes to even small things like creating characters and portraying them in a certain way, like certain characters you always portray in a certain light. Why? Because that helps to paint the picture of who this character is. And you do that consistently. You do not just paint them as a normal individual. You paint them as, oh, this is the villain. Okay, well, they always are portrayed with that. If it's, let's just say, a sinister look, then portray the sinister look. If it's a, you know, an idealistic, whatever, you know, you always portray them in this light because it is that consistent building of this character over the small term that builds that long-term view of who this character is. And I think it's the same way in life for us, where you have these small sections of life, the small things are what really build us into the people that we are. So it's not unreasonable to say that applies to life as well. But yeah, I do think that the nuanced look is hard to get in a movie, especially because this movie's three times as long as the average movie, and you still don't get that same nuance that you're going to get in 20 hours of listening to The Return of the King and in a novel form, right?
Yes, and I want to give some leeway for that, mm-hmm. but I do, and you know, I will probably point this out again later, but Jackson's choices with what he chooses to spend time on bother me. Because you miss all this stuff, and I get you can't have everything, but if you're going to spend how many minutes of the movie did we spend with Gimli and Legolas having a drinking contest? And it's like, my buddy's laughing at this, and this is something he saw growing up, and it's really funny. And it's like, I get that this is a fun moment and we're enjoying it. And it's like, okay, cool. But what are you sacrificing to put that in the movie? Gimli's being a funny idiot, and you get Legolas being like, oh, I think I feel something after like 18 beers. And it's like, that's funny.
Right.
And then you skip over some other stuff that's like, what do we think of those choices? So that's that's another issue I have with Jackson's portrayal.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think that's going to affect my rating specifically. I do think that certain examples such as Denethor are very compelling as examples of what needs to be changed. I think that so part of this tension as a director is how can you create a narrative which is very compelling but at the same time is engaging to audiences who maybe haven't read the books, right? Or haven't watched. And so can you make sure that you are still engaging them in the same way? I think that some of the times having those jokes does engage other people who maybe aren't as interested. So, for example, I think one of the faults of especially some of the Star Wars movies, especially some of the prequels, especially Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith, is that they have a lot of lightsaber duels, right? And that's very engaging for a very, very specific group of audiences, right? But that doesn't mean that there are some people who, frankly, are more compelled by, let's just say, the romance aspect of Revenge of the Sith or the other narrative portions of the movie that you lose because you spent 15 minutes of a two-hour movie that is just with the lightsabers out, not including the rest of the conflict that goes around the lightsaber fight, right? So you're talking about a good half the movie that's just in regards to these conflicts around the lightsabers, not regarding the other conflicts of the story. So I think that keeping those things in tension is difficult from a writer and director standpoint to have that balance. And yeah, I'm not going to fault him for the drinking scene with Legolas and Gimli.
I totally get where you're coming from. And I've got a lot of sympathy for the way that a director has to make choices like that. So like, for instance, you're not going to see me complaining about, and I mean, like if you were talking about the Fellowship, I wouldn't talk about, oh, you cut the Tom Bombadil stuff. Oh man.
Yeah.
Like that's like a 40-minute segment of your movie something that's really relating to, like, Tolkien had a thought for that, and it was relating to something outside the books.
Right.
And I totally get why you wouldn't include that in the movie. That makes a lot of sense. That's a good, you have to make choices, and it makes sense to me. But to me, if you're going to make choices that change the feel, the tone, and the ultimate message of the movie, of the book, of the source material, to fit for modern audiences what they want to see, if you can't make that happen and keep the tone, keep the meaning, keep the overarching values of the story, you shouldn't do it. And my dad has read these books since he was a kid, and he calls Peter Jackson a slob. Ruined the books. Ruined them for my dad. He can't watch the movies. He watched the first one and it ruined it for him. He couldn't read the book for like years. So for my dad, he could have done that with something else. He could have chosen a different story and he could have gotten a similar thing out of it. But because he had a medium that had specific constraints, and I understand that like a lot of people love these movies, and it's because he took a really, really good story, and the story on its face is excellent. He took an excellent story and he slapped it into a movie, and then he painted on the parts that he liked and he kind of erased the parts he didn't, and that's how movie making works. I get it, but he shouldn't have done it to that story if he couldn't have done it right. And that's what I think happened there. And that's like the drinking scene is a microcosm of the problems that I have with this movie. They're really good movies if you just watch them and you have no opinions based on the books. But if you read the books and then you see the movies, there are some issues. So sorry, I don't want to go on about that too long.
No, that's I mean, obviously I disagree, but I think that that's a good perspective to have. When you think, especially as a fan of the books, of the problems in the movies, what is the biggest problem that sticks out in your mind?
The biggest problem is the Hobbits. And it's the overarching storyline with the Hobbits. So you've got to go back to the Fellowship. Mm-hmm. Specifically Merry and Pippin. They joined by accident. They're silly and stupid. Every single one of their lines is like a comedic moment. You need comedic relief in a movie. I get it. But the Hobbits are supposed to be a shockingly vital and important part of the story of Middle Earth and the Third Age. Mm-hmm. And they come in and they do these things that nobody thought was possible. Mm-hmm. And so you get in the books, you have these Hobbits. They know they're going into danger. Merry and Pippin, they find out that their friend, they care for Frodo deeply, and they know that something's going on. So they discover what's going on. They make him take them with him to Rivendell. They go to Rivendell, and then they insist on going after. They know they're going into darkness. They know that things are going to go poorly. They don't know how bad they're going to go, and things get very dark for them. Mm-hmm. But they always have hope. They're always Hobbits, and there's something about their indomitable spirit in the face of everything, in the face of the big people continuing to make these incredibly important moments. I mean, Merry helps kill the Witch King. Mm-hmm. Insane. Frodo brings down Sauron. Frodo could not have done it without Sam. And Gollum, who was a Hobbit or some similar race, is involved directly in that as well. And it's very clear from the outset that Gandalf knows that Gandalf says from the Fellowship on, what is it? The mercy of Bilbo may rule the fates of many.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
which is excellent foreshadowing.
Frodo has the wisdom. Right. Frodo has the wisdom to Gollum leads them, and Sam's like, this is a huge mistake. And Frodo's like, you think I don't know what he's doing? I know what he's doing. But what choice do we have? He won't kill him. He won't do anything to him. And that leads Sam to go at the very end when Sam could kill Gollum at the foot of Mount Doom. He doesn't do it. And that is what leads to the ring being destroyed. That's what defeats everything. In the end, it was Bilbo's mercy continued by Frodo, continued by Sam.
Yeah.
And you just lose that entirely. So that's my biggest concern.
I loved how you encapsulated that. That's beautiful. So as an audience, I get what you're saying. The big thing that sticks out in my mind is in the Return of the King, it's about the Hobbits, as you say in the books, but also it's called The Return of the King. Which almost, it indicates a different priority. So, like, if that's the priority as a devil's advocate, like, what do you say to that? Like, if anything, the title indicates that that's not the priority of the book.
The response to that would probably be that absolutely that's the priority of the book. But how can the king return if he can't rule, and he can't rule if Sauron's going to destroy him? And you see this at the end of the book too. And you don't get as much of this in the movie, which I was sad about. Aragorn kneels before Frodo and Sam, and they're like embarrassed about it because they're hobbits. They don't need this. And Aragorn kneels before them and he goes, "You are to be honored." And there's like the scene where he's like, praise them with great praise, like six times. He's like having everybody chant. They go through the city. Frodo bears the crown and gives it to Gandalf to crown the king. So Aragorn, super important, epic character. He's the one who's restoring this kingdom, but he can't do it alone. And it turns out nobody could have done any of it at all. Everything that all these great men would do would be for naught. All these epic battles and everything, and they know it. When they go to the Black Gates, they know that all they are is a distraction, and that's all they've been. They're just holding on until Frodo does his thing.
That does reprioritize the value back on the Hobbits. That's I think I like that response. Did you think that this movie consistently takes the heroes and puts them from a bad situation into a worse situation?
Ooh. Yeah, it just keeps getting worse. It's terrible. And they do it to themselves, and the reasons they're doing it are really good. I mean, it's, you know, you go through Shelob's lair, mm-hmm. because you're trying to get into Mordor.
Right.
Pretty mm-hmm. rough. And then you get to Gondor and you have to defeat a massive army, and then you're like, okay, we now hold Gondor. Let's leave Gondor and go to our enemy's stronghold.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, man.
Yeah. It's pretty good. I do agree. Faramir almost dies, Theoden dies, Frodo gets poisoned and captured, all that good stuff. I am curious to get your take, and I don't want to like go too deep into this because I think I know where you're going to go with this, but I do think it's worth mentioning because I think this is definitely different from the books, is the scene going up the stairs to Ciriath Ungol with Frodo and Sam. And in the movies, you see that Frodo is slowly being turned away from Sam, and that Gollum is corrupting his mind in some degree, until you have the line in the movie where Frodo says, "Go home," and then they separate ways, right? That, in my mind, is a scene that definitely raises the stakes, right? Right, makes it worse and goes, okay, now Frodo is all alone. What was your thoughts on that situation?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that you predicted my response is that I hated it. It is
strong words.
I really did hate it because Sam is such an important character, and Sam and Frodo were like two sides of a coin. Frodo is so emotional. And he's got this poetic side to him that he kind of gets from Bilbo. Mm-hmm. He loves Elvish, and he, you know, he makes poetry and music. And he's also wise. He's learned his letters. He's read histories. He knows all this stuff. He knows he can speak some Elvish. Frodo is one of those rare, deep characters that you get mm-hmm. and among the hobbits. Mm-hmm. And Bilbo's another one like him, you know, like uncle, like nephew, I guess. right. Or yeah, it's uncle, I think. But in those moments, I'm not going to harp on it too long, but you lose the part. I said earlier, Frodo knows that Gollum is up to no good. Frodo mm-hmm. knows exactly what Gollum's after. There is no illusion there. He makes Gollum swear on the ring because he knows that's the only thing that will hold him. And he says, I don't know how long this will hold, but we have no other choices. Sam... like Gollum, ooh, getting rid of the whey bread and sprinkling crumbs over Sam. Frodo is turning slowly into a Nazgul or a Ringwraith. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that is changing who he is. But he doesn't need any help from Gollum to get through this change. Like Gollum mm-hmm. wants the ring and he's going to do what he can, but Gollum already has a plan. It's to get rid of Frodo and Shelob's lair, and Shelob can take care of two hobbits, no problem. So there's no real need to get rid of Sam in that moment. So that scene, it just, what it did for me was it said, okay, Peter Jackson doesn't understand Sam and Frodo's relationship. Sam, if Frodo had said, go home, Sam, even if he had been like, you know, held by, and I can understand where you might add that tension in where, okay, Frodo's being taken slowly over by the ring and, you know, he's making decisions that don't make sense because he's, you know, things are going very poorly for him because he has this burden. But the burden doesn't make him lose his mind. The burden is turning him into an Nazgul. And it's important to note that it's doing it more slowly than it should because he's a hobbit. But Sam is unable to, he can't live without his master. He's not going to abandon him. If Frodo sent him away, Sam would wait and then follow. He would never leave him. He would never, ever, Sam going back down the stairs, ludicrous. Never would happen. And I think that it just shows a complete misunderstanding of their relationship.
I don't disagree. I don't think I disagree that it misrepresents the narrative of Frodo and Sam from the books compared to the movies, and it's not the same. That's true. I'm not convinced that it's a bad storytelling technique, I guess, is maybe where I'm coming from, is that I think as a narrative piece, I think it makes things so much worse than it would be if he had stayed true to him, because Sam as a character feels like all of his value, which is to protect Frodo, right, and be in some ways this asset to him, is for naught, that it's nothing, that he is not valued, and it takes him seeing the Lembas bread on the stones to realize that Frodo might not feel like he needs me right now, but he needs me, and that's what I need to do, is to come back and fight for my master. And that I think is a narrative technique I still really appreciated, but I do see what you're saying. I do see that it does change who he is as a book in the book compared to the movies, for sure.
Yeah, I can appreciate the fact that might be a narrative technique, but again, I question Jackson's inclusion of certain things that were never in the books, and exclusion of things that maybe could have done a similar thing. So,
okay, yeah. So when you're thinking of, when you think of a technique that helps, like in my mind, that's not the most iconic scene in the movie, but it is a strong scene that shows an emotional pull as an audience, where you go, oh my goodness, no, he's losing his one asset in this dark situation. When you think of another scenario that would cause that same result, what exactly are you thinking of from the books?
The moment when he finds out that Frodo is still alive. Mm-hmm. Heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. Just because that moment doesn't have the same, pull. And again, like, if you're going to tell the story with Sam and Frodo having a different relationship, you have to pull tricks like this to get emotion from the audience. But if you pull it the same way it is from the story, and this is something that, like, you kind of have to remember that Tolkien was writing in a time when there were real class differences, and Frodo is Sam's master. And he loves his master more than anything. He leaves everything he knows for this guy. He has an opportunity when Galadriel shows him what might happen to the Shire, which is arguably the second most thing in his heart. Mm-hmm. And he goes, I have to turn around. I have to go back. And then he goes, no, I'm going to follow Mr. Frodo regardless of what happens. And you get to this point and there's a tiff with Smeagol, and it's all gone. Who cares? Off goes Sam. And then Sam gets back up and he's like, oh no, Frodo. Well, grab his stuff and leave. And he grabs his stuff and he goes in the corner. The orcs come and he realizes that he's alive. And he's like, oh shoot. Well, I better go get him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm underplaying it. The movie does a better job of the emotional part. But it doesn't have the same impact it would have if Sam had stuck with him this whole time. You get this heart-wrenching moment where Sam has fought with this creature in the dark tunnels of Shelob's lairs. He fought Shelob and he's injured her, and he's laid his master out and he cuts him loose and he's like, okay, I'm trying to like leave him at rest. And, you know, he has this sad moment and he's like, what else can I do but go on? That's it. He's lost everything. He has nothing left to live for in that moment. And then you get that. He gets it back. And it's even more terrible in the moment he realizes his master is still alive and he has condemned him to be tortured to death.
Yeah.
So, I think it could have been done differently.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, I still don't hate the scene, but I respect where you're coming from for sure. Is there any?
I can understand it narratively how that makes sense. Yeah.
And that's good. That's what these discussions are for. You know, at the end of the day, as long as we can disagree, but still respect where the other person is coming from, that's what's most important, right? Revelations. I think, is there any big revelations in this movie? And did this movie have a surprise ending?
Revelations is an interesting one. I think a lot of the revelations for this come a lot earlier in the series, like in the Fellowship mm-hmm. mostly, and a little bit in the Two Towers. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think there's a ton that I can think of off the top of my head that are like, oh, wow, who saw that coming? Mm-hmm. Except for the end, obviously, where you have that yeah. surprise. Like, that's a pretty shocking ending.
Right.
You know, Frodo betrays everything.
Right.
You know, he's finally, right. he has fallen to the ring, and he puts it on, and you're like, oh, no, what a twist!
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
Smeagol comes in like a WWE fighter, launches himself onto Frodo, bites uh-huh. his finger off,
uh-huh.
and then tumbles into the lava and dies, and
right.
thus ends Sauron. And right. wow, what a roller coaster in the last right. like 10 minutes. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
yeah, so that's pretty yeah. big.
Uh-huh. No, I agree. I'll go back to my other point later about potentially, but I think most importantly is the surprise ending twist of at the end of all of this, right? You have Frodo, who is this character who has persevered through it all, and he has come to the moment of truth where he has the ring over the lava of Mount Doom, and he says, mm-hmm. never mind, I have changed my mind, this now belongs to me. And that just... Yep. It takes everything that he's fought for and makes it all for naught. But at the end of the day, it means that the Sauron has won, that he has taken over this, you know, this small creature who could not be conquered and subdues him to his will, which was the power of the ring all along. It subdues everyone, but no, because Gollum comes in and this very lust for power and this desire for the ring ends up being its own downfall because Gollum... takes it and then stumbles into the fires of Mount Doom himself. So yeah, it's one of the iconic endings to a movie where it's like this very desire for the ring is the reason that the ring gets destroyed, which is
right.
Is ironic in some ways. It's a twist of fate that no one expects, but it is because of that twist that this destruction occurs and that the evil is overcome. So I love it. I think, and I don't know, I don't think it's that much different. It's a little different from the book compared to the movies, but overall pretty consistent.
Yeah. My only gripe with it. And I think I wrote
my
this
only gripe for every single one of these questions. Sorry. Keep going.
You're right. But Frodo gets back up, and he attacks Gollum.
Mm-hmm.
And like, here's the thing. Logically, that makes so much sense. Because mm-hmm. Frodo's over the edge.
Mm-hmm.
And in every other scene where Gollum or Sam has the ring or suggests taking the ring or anything like that, Frodo is like, I'll fight you. Mm-hmm. Or actually fights them. But mm-hmm. in that moment, for me, narratively, it was like, couldn't we just let him fall? Because then
just
you don't have, nobody's guilty of Gollum's death. Whereas in this one, it's like, you could blame Frodo for it, but that's a minor, yeah, minor nitpick. Yeah. It's so good. And it's very interesting that you pointed out, I didn't think of this, that Gollum, the very thing that drew Gollum to the ring, the thing that gives the ring so much power over everybody mm-hmm. was its downfall. Its yeah. own power was its downfall. I hadn't thought of it like that before. But what I did think of when I was reading it again was the way the book has it. And you can't really do this in the movie. It would be incredibly difficult. I don't even know how you mm-hmm. go about doing it. But it's so fun, and it's such a nice ending in some ways. Because when Frodo puts on the ring, the audience goes, oh, no, that's
yeah.
it. It's all over yeah. now. Because we know that once Frodo puts the ring on, Sauron sees him.
Exactly.
He'll take over this little hobbit. That'll be the end of everything. Mm. And in the book, you have the narrator goes, and in that moment, Sauron saw his doom. Because he sees Frodo and he's like, he is in Mount Doom. He's in Mount
yeah,
Doom.
Yeah, yeah.
He is there. That's yeah. where that thing goes to die.
Yeah.
Crap. And yeah. he sends the Nazgul and he's like, go, 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 go.
Yeah.
And he's got this terror because this is the end for him if he doesn't get that ring.
Yeah.
And so you have, it's really fun to think about, like, especially for first time readers or watchers, you see this moment and you're like, oh my gosh, it's all over for them. And Sauron's thinking the same thing. And so I just think that's really fun. And that was like a great thing that Tolkien did. So that's, I just think that's fun. And it kind of ties into what you were saying about the ring is its own doom.
Well, especially because what I love about how Tolkien does this is that, like you said, Sauron is his own entity, right? He's this mysterious figure, but he's never walking around. He's never talking with people. He's never discussing anything. And so anything that you see about who Sauron is or how Sauron as the villain is feeling in this scene, it's all related by his minions and the characters that he controls. Yep. And so definitely with the ring wraiths, for sure, for the Nazgul, you get this sense of his desperation in this moment where they are coming down to destroy Aragorn and all of their forces, and they book it backwards and they go, nope, this is time. There's a new priority right now, because if we don't solve this right now, I am a dead man. So it's very great at like showing the desperation of Sauron. Yeah. And I will say, as much as we critiqued the eye, the literal eye of Sauron, I do think that it was what was interesting to me in this watch of the movie is that Sauron, when he's doing the thing we made fun of, the lighthouse shotgun view, right? Where he's eyeing where Frodo and Sam just were, right? Because he thinks they're there, right? That's going on during Aragorn having his discussion with the mouth of Sauron at the front of the Black Gates. And what that showed as a perspective of the audience is that there's this big thing happening right outside the front doorstep of Sauron. But Sauron is so desperate to get the ring, and he thinks he knows where it is, that he's more focused on where he thinks the ring is than the thing right in front of his front door. And I thought that was an interesting perspective as an audience to go, that Sauron didn't even bat an eye looking at the force in front of his gates because he was so desperate for the ring, until the moment where the mouth of Sauron's head is cut off. And then he reprioritizes and says, okay, now let's destroy these people because now they're pissing me off, you know? So as much as I don't
that's like, interesting.
I agree. I don't like the whole eye shot thing that much. But in that scene, as much as I kind of thought it was a joke, it was interesting to think about, like, this is the priority of Sauron. This is what he thinks is most important. And he goes, oh, are they there? Are they there? And he's looking. And that's why when he falls, it's like, oh, we don't know. And it adds that doubt to Sauron's mind. But he's so desperate for the ring this entire time, and that shows this desperation of the Dark Lord.
You see, this is why this is good, because for me, I was like, I don't like that. I didn't like that part of that scene. That didn't make any sense to me. And it's because in my mind, I'm like, well, this is how it happens in the book. But obviously you have a narrator in the book that's explaining the motives and the understanding of like what's going on with Sauron, or you have a scene where Gandalf is explaining it or something like that.
Right.
And you can't necessarily fit all that stuff into a book. All that stuff into a movie.
Right.
And so as much as I don't like the eye and that stuff in that scene, I can see where it would be really useful to kind of convey the general attitude and thought of a bodiless being. Right. So that's interesting. I hadn't thought about it that way.
Well, it's especially hard because a lot of times in these narratives, in the books, you'll get this dialogue internally in people's minds, or like you said, the narrator explaining things. And as a director, it's very hard to convey that in the same way unless you have this echoey voice just speaking into the speakers of everyone's home as they watch the movie, which is kind of weird to do. So it's like, how can you portray the same
idea? Different type of movie.
Yeah, exactly. How do you portray that in the same way? And I think that as the eye does, this is one case where the eye actually does that well.
Yeah, I don't love it, and I would have done it differently. But that's a good point to make. Yeah.
Well, thank you. Did you think grew as a person? Does the movie have a theme that comes to mind when you're watching it? What did you think of the transformation of these characters in this story.
Right. So again, this is another one where it's like, okay, if we take it on its face as like, this is a standalone movie, we're ignoring the books. You've mm-hmm. got, it's a pretty good Bildungsroman for Aragorn. He's got this character arc where he comes into his own as king. There's this moment where he's in the palace. Like, I didn't understand why they had him do the Palantir later until I thought about it more along the lines of, okay, Aragorn's the main character and he's coming into his own. Because the Palantir scene in The Return of the King in the book is at the beginning. But in the movie, it's middle, towards the end. It's after all these battles. So Aragorn is in Gondor. He's in Minas Tirith. And he is now coming into his own. Yeah. And I thought that those moments were like, okay, if you look at it with that, from that kind of narrative process of like, okay, they made Aragorn really the main character. Mm-hmm. He's coming to his own. He has the confidence to look into the Palantir and speak with Sauron.
Right.
And then he takes his army out to fight in a hopeless battle. Mm-hmm. I mean, you get some pretty good payoff in terms of where he comes from the beginning, feeling like a little like this tension between like who he is as a person and what he's able to do and how confident he is. And then in the end, he is king and he has returned. So I can appreciate that. And I think that that's a pretty good narrative arc. You've got a lot of the things you really need in a story to make that character work. But again, if you approach it from, okay, why are the hobbits here? What is the point of the hobbits? Why are they in the story at all? Pippin and Merry kind of Merry less so. The movie does a better job with Merry. But Pippin specifically, he's kind of a silly little character and he kills an orc. And he does a couple of other things that are good. Like he saves Faramir kind of is really Gandalf. But he doesn't really get that arc. He doesn't get that culmination of that growth that you really want to see. And that's where I kind of run into this point of like, you killed Saruman. So you don't get this satisfying moment of having the hobbits go back home and having a moment similar to Aragorn where they have returned, but they are much changed. They are masters of themselves and masters of others. They're great.
You're talking about the hobbits specifically?
Yes, the hobbits, yeah. Sam, Frodo, Merry, Pippin. You know, they return and they've done great things and they've traveled far and they come back and the Shire has all these problems. And oh no, it's so terrible. And the hobbits that are living there are like, we can't do anything about this.
Right.
And the hobbits that return, the book, it's like, it's almost funny because the hobbits come back and they're like, you kidding me? This is what you're dealing with? All right, let me handle this. And they come in and they just like, it's you know, it's not nothing, but it's Saruman is a dangerous enough villain. You know, he's been stripped of his powers, but he's still a dangerous enough villain to make it compelling, while also being like, this is the end. Right. And it ties that storyline up in a neat bow. And it's like, okay, so cinematically, standalone movie, you've got a good character arc for Aragorn and you've got it really pays off. But in terms of the hobbits, you don't really see that in the movies, and it really takes away from, again, you know, my thought process is that the hobbits really are the main characters and you lose that entirely. So sorry, went on a bit there, but that's my
sure. No, I think that that's I think that's a good thing to keep in mind, especially because it is the end of the story. Like, how well have these characters progressed? I do think that I agree that they do put a large amount of emphasis on Aragorn as a character in this story, and so his arc as a character is pretty solid, especially in regards to, you know, the courage of man to stand up and fight in the midst of these evils is an important arc, and they play it out well, considering that that is a priority in the story compared to probably in the books. I think the perseverance of Frodo is a great demonstration as well, but that is also kept in mind in the grander arc of the three movies versus just in this one, because it's not as well, it's not as thoroughly developed, let's just say, in this one without the other two. What did you think of the ending? Did the movie leave you satisfied? Were you unsatisfied? What did you think? I already know. Go ahead, say your piece.
So, I mean, the ending is actually not that different from the book.
Right.
They all go off to the Grey Havens. I mean, like, there's some minor differences in, like, who finds out when and what Sam thinks is happening. But they go off to the Grey Havens together. And I mean, like, oh, it is such, like, I didn't used to understand this. And first time I read it, I didn't really get it. But I think I get it now. A lot of people cry when they read the books and they get to the end the first time. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful, and it's everything is turned out for the best, and it's so sad because Frodo is gone. Mm-hmm. Sam loses Frodo, and you don't get the same payoff in the movies because the relationship is completely different. But in terms of like how it ended, it's you know, in terms of the movie and the book, it's almost the exact same ending.
Okay,
and yet it's a completely and an entirely different ending from the book somehow, because of all the feelings that go along with it, I think. And I can't say, like, I think that as far as just taking the book, taking the movie as it is in and of itself, it's a good ending. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It makes sense. Frodo goes off into the West with the remaining elves and Bilbo, and Sam has to go back home. And, you know, I like that they had that. They had Frodo voiceover, or Elijah Wood voiceover, that line about Sam, you need to be whole. You cannot always be torn in two. And that's like in the book, that's huge payoff, because Sam is always saying, I'm that torn in two, because he's like, he wants to go back to the Shire and help them, but he wants to stay with Master Frodo, or he wants to do this, but he wants to do that too. So you get that payoff in the book. You don't get it as much in the movie, but I did like that they had that voiceover at the end and are like, you have to be whole and you have to be with your family. And you get nice, it's a cute little ending. You got, he goes back home when he picks up Rose, not Rose, Eleanor. So yeah, I actually, maybe, I don't know if maybe that was less nitpicky than you thought it would be, but
yeah. No, yeah. I mean, the general impression I'm getting from you as a whole is like, if this movie existed devoid of the books, you would enjoy it a lot. But
if you take this book in a, sorry, go ahead.
No. But like, if you take the books and all of this greatness that comes from the novels as a whole, and then you realize this is the content that it's based off of, you feel like there's so much lacking. Is that a good analysis?
That's a really excellent analysis of exactly where I'm coming from. I really think that Peter Jackson, he took, I mean, every time I think of this, I think of that Jeff Goldblum quote from Jurassic Park. You know, it's nice. Like they took something and they didn't have to do anything to earn it. And they were so busy doing it that they didn't stop to ask whether or not they should do it. They were asking if they could do it. They should have asked to stop to ask if they could do it. Yeah. So it's, to me, it's, he took a really, really good story and he made three good action movies and completely missed the entire point of the stories in the process. And so I hold him responsible for the fact that there hasn't been a remake. There hasn't been anything that's been satisfying to me or my father or anybody else who agrees with me, which is not many people, which is why there hasn't been a remake. And I can understand there's politics that go into this, and the fact that Hollywood is Hollywood, and it's really difficult to get somebody to do like an HBO Game of Thrones-esque kind of massive series on the Lord of the Rings in 2003. That would have been unheard of, I think. Like, they wouldn't have done it. Right. Now they know there's an audience for it. And my deepest hope is that someday somebody will come at the material and remake it in a faithful way. I don't think it'll ever happen, though. And I hold Peter Jackson responsible for the fact that that will never happen, and he could have chosen something else.
There's some strong words. I do think it's interesting, though, to think about what you said at the beginning with Christopher Tolkien and how he was disappointed with the turnout as well. And I at the very least, I do think that that points to something being lacking in the story that Christopher Tolkien, at the very least, thought was fundamental to the narrative. So take that as you will, as an audience. That's I think that's about a good spot to end it. So that's the pod. We hope you all enjoyed. We will be back next week, as we always are. Of course, this will be an extended piece for you all. We hope you all enjoyed. But yeah, next week, another one. We will see you all then.